Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Clones, welcome to the Daily Jungle. Huge weekend of football. I was all over it. I hopped on that bird for my hit on the NFL Today on CBS. Nailed that. Almost lost my lapper and my new iPhone 10. Found them both, made it back in one piece. Now, the Steelers and Patriots game lived up to all the hype, even if the catch rule did its best to get in the way. The Rams absolutely smashed the Seahawks. What the hell has happened there? And the Browns kept the dream alive. Do not now, guys. Mike Freeman, the Bleacher Report, came in. Jacksonville's Calais Campbell, a day after locking up the Jags' first playoff appearance in a decade, also was on the show and killed it. It is our last week of 2017. The Daily Jungle starts right now. The Patriots and the Steelers, the game of the season. And every single year we have one, of course. The game of the season does not always live up to the hype. In fact, it almost never does. But yesterday, it did. Pat Steelers was the game of the season, and it had everything you could ever hope for. A couple of Hall of Fame quarterbacks, trading shots, one-handed TD grabs, TD celebrations, Gronk doing what Gronk does. Le'Veon Bell doing what he does. A last-minute go-ahead touchdown followed by another near-last-minute touchdown. Oh, and controversy. A ton of controversy. And that's normally what happens in games of the season. The Patriots find a way to win it. Controversy and the Pats find a way to get it done. I mean, there was so much in that game that there's barely enough time in a three-hour program to cover it all, much less slam it all into an open. I could spend 3 hours on it today and still not get to everything. In any other game, this moment, with 30 seconds left in the first half, is the only thing that people would be talking about. Ben Roethlisberger to Martavis Bryant. More accurately, Ben Roethlisberger to Martavis Bryant's right hand.
Bell in motion, empties the set. Third and goal at the four. Ben gets the snap, throws it to the end zone, and it's caught in the end zone by Martavis Bryant. You talk about floating a ball to a wide receiver. That ball had plenty of air under it.
That's an amazing catch. Great catch. And then Juju Smith-Schuster capped it with a TD celebration that recreated his hit on Vontaze Burfict. You know, the hit that got him suspended. Hey, look, I love Juju. I want him on my team badly. I love his game. I love his energy. I love his attitude. I mean, I love the guy, but I don't love that. Probably should not be reenacting a moment that got you suspended. But as wild as that TD and celebration were, it still had nothing on the final minute of the game. With just under 4 minutes to go, the Patriots kick a field goal. They get it within five. Then they force a three and out. Then they get the ball back, and then they go right down the field. 77 yards, and they cap it off with this.
Lewis, the single setback. Two receivers right. Hand off to Deion. Runs it through the left side. Into the end zone. Touchdown. And the lead to the Patriots.
As you probably imagine, that was Pat's radio. Then they chase that with a two-point conversion, and they've got a three-point lead, 27-24. Classic Patriots, down for much of the game, finding a way to win on the road when they need to take the lead for home field advantage. I mean, absolutely vintage Patriots. But the Steelers did show something yesterday. They were not intimidated by the Pats. They didn't blink, even when they were without Antonio Brown. And they didn't fold this time either, because this time it was going to be different. This time, they were outplaying the Pats. They had them in their house. The top seed in the conference was hanging in the balance, and they were way too good and way too proud to continue to get abused by Brady and Belichick every single year. No, Roethlisberger was not going to let them lose. Not this time, not this year, and not in their house. And then he hit Smith-Schuster on a short crossing route, which turned out to be so much more.
From the 21, Ben gets a snap. He's back. Fires it on a crossing route. That's Juju Smith-Schuster running up the field. Still on his feet. He's going to the 40. Cuts inside at the 30. Looks to pick up a blocker at the 20. And he's hit, and he's down inside the 15 at the 10-yard line. How did he stay inbound?
Wow, you talk about walking the tightrope.
Pittsburgh.
There's still 34 seconds left in this football game. That was amazing.
Steelers radio, and that's what I mean when I say I want Juju on my team. I love that guy. I want that guy on my team. 69 yards down to the Patriots 10. Well within field goal range to tie it up. Perfectly placed to win that game. To drive a stake in them. Finish it once and for all. Do that, and then the Berg parties all night long. Man, if only it were that simple. And of course it's not. It never is, especially when these two get together. And deep down, given the way the Pats have dominated the Steelers in the Brady Belichick era, Steeler fan had to know that something horrible was going to happen. And then something horrible did happen.
Ben in the shotgun. Gets the snap, wants to throw it.
Throws it for the touchdown to Jesse James. Would you believe that? The Steelers leapfrog back ahead.
Here's Tony Corrente, and this is mighty, mighty big.
This is huge.
Is it a touchdown or is it
After
not?
After reviewing the play, the receiver in the end zone did not survive the ground. It's an incomplete pass.
I told you.
Pittsburgh's ball, second down and 10 at the 10-yard line.
Oh,
the game clock is correct, and
we'll
start on the next snap.
Uh-oh! Completion, touchdown, ball game. Let's not get into that just yet. Actually, upon review, not the ball game, not a touchdown, and not a completion. And so it begins, a tradition unlike any other, discussing whether something was a catch or wasn't. Calvin, Dez, and now Jesse, and so many in between. It seems like every single week there's a is it a catch controversy, and almost none of them ever have a satisfactory ending. So, why don't we do this? Let's turn to NFL Senior VP of Officiating, Al Riveron, for an official explanation.
As we can see here, Roethlisberger completes a pass to James, and James is going to the ground as he reaches the goal line. And that's the key here. He is going to the ground. By rule, to complete the process of the catch, he must survive the ground. And by that, we mean he must maintain control of the football. As we see here, he does put the ball over the goal line extended. Once he gets there, he loses control of the football, and then the ball hits the ground. We can see here the ball touches the ground. So therefore, two things occur. He loses control of the football, and the ball touches the ground prior to him regaining control. Therefore, the ruling on the field of a touchdown was changed to an incomplete pass.
Holy crap, are you kidding me with that? Are you kidding me with all that? I mean, kind of awkward that the explanation for explaining why Roethlisberger's pass was not completed includes the phrase, Roethlisberger completed a pass. It included that phrase. Hey, look, this guy's right. He is right. The officials got it right ultimately. According to the rule, that's correct. According to the rule, that's not a catch. But really, who the hell knows? Because it seems like it changes every single week. There is not a fan in the stands or watching at home who can tell me the definition of a catch. Hell, I'm not even sure the players can tell me at this point the definition of a catch. I don't know how to define a catch. It's not my job, but it is somebody else's job. And they're not doing it very well if the players, the coaches, and the fans don't even know what a catch is. And if the players don't know, how the hell will anybody else know? That is a catch, isn't it a catch debate is so bad that it overshadows even this.
So the clock is ticking. Steelers are out of timeouts. 14 seconds to go. It's third and goal from the six. And Ben is back, throws it over the middle.
Intercepted. Oh, my goodness.
It's intercepted by New England. Harmon comes up with a pick.
Oh,
my goodness gracious.
What a way to
play is ruled as an interception and a touchback.
You go from the top of the mountain right to the bottom.
Oh, boy. I just feel like I got punched in the stomach.
And kicked in the junk. A truly brutal interception on the goal line when all the Steelers needed was a field goal to send it into overtime. Now, any other game, and all we're talking about is whether Ben should have gone with the actual spike or whether you admire the guts of going for the fake spike and debating who called for it. Any other game, and we're hyping the Pats for a great comeback and a gutsy win and discussing whether the Steelers win that game if Antonio Brown is healthy and counting down the days until these two teams meet again. But instead, we're not talking about all that. We're talking about was it or was it not a catch? Great game, terrible rule. Great game, terrible rule. If the rule requires that level of explanation, it's not a good rule. Here's a better rule for you. If the player catches the ball, it's a catch. How about that? Pretty simple. If the player catches the ball, it's a catch. That's something everybody understands. That's how you know it's a catch. If the guy catches it, it's a catch. Because it seems like every single year they try to explain or improve the rule and it never gets any better. In fact, if anything, it gets even worse. We get new phrases every time like football move. And now this. Survive the ground. Survive the ground. I mean, seriously, for the last time. For the last time. If the guy makes the catch, it's a catch. That's how you know it's a catch. If the guy makes the catch, it's a catch. You're welcome. If you need any more help with that, you know where to find me. Clones, give me one moment so I can talk to you about my pals at Stamps.com. Listen, these days, you can get practically everything on demand, such as our podcast. Listen whenever you want, when it's convenient for you. So let me ask you, why are you still going to the post office and dealing with their limited hours when you can get postage on demand with Stamps.com? Anything that you can do at the post office, you can now do right from your desk. As an example, the holidays are coming up. My wife, Janet, is all about the Christmas card. We send out hundreds, literally hundreds of Christmas cards, and there's no way we could do it without Stamps.com. I'm going to print my own postage. I'm going to do it when I want and do it at home. Trust me, with the holidays coming up, you should do the exact same thing, and you'll thank me for it. Go to Stamps.com, hit the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in jungle. That's Stamps.com, enter jungle for a special, special offer. A four-week trial, which includes postage and a digital scale. Do not wait. You want to go to Stamps.com, and before you do anything else, hit the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in jungle. That's Stamps.com, enter jungle. Stamps.com. Never go to the post office ever again. I know I won't. Stamps.com. My guest, Mike Freeman. Mike, good morning. What's going on? How are you?
Jim, just another day in the NFL, another day where you don't know what the hell a catch is.
I was going to say, Mike, you ripped my thunder. I was going to say there's so many things we can talk about coming out this weekend, but why don't we start with the easy one, Mike? What is a catch?
I don't know. Right? Why don't you tell me, Jim? We need to diagram what this is because and, you know, I was at that game covering the Steelers-Patriots game, and you see that play. Everyone's seen that play. The problem is for the NFL, look, that play was called correctly. The rule was called correctly, but it's a stupid rule. So every fan watching that looks at that and goes, that's a touchdown. I mean, by any definition that you think you know football, that's a touchdown. But because the NFL treats all these rules like they're building a nuclear power plant, and they use all these stupid terms and these stupid things to obscure it, then you're left sort of wondering what the hell is a catch. And this has been a problem with the NFL for a long time. I mean, they've obscured what a catch is with the Dez Bryant one and the Calvin Johnson rule and all these other stupid things. So you don't know. It's confusing now. I mean, the refs don't even know. One ref called it a touchdown. They review it. They overturn it. So the league really needs to sort of fix that because the fan sees a play and says that's a touchdown, and the rule book says something different.
That's exactly right. Great game, bad rule. Great game, bad rule. And, Mike, it is confusing, but it shouldn't be confusing. And the reason it's not confusing is if the man catches the ball, it's a catch. And that clearly was a catch, but not according to the rule. Now, while we're at it, Mike, as long as we're defining what is and what is not a catch, when you see Gene Steratore break out a piece of paper to measure for a first down, Mike, what exactly is a first down?
Jim, this is a league worth many billions, and they're using chains for the first down and folded up pieces of paper to determine whether or not you get a first. I mean, this is a sophisticated league run by billionaires and smart people most of the time, and they're doing that. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I've never seen that before. A ref break out a piece of paper, and, I mean, that's the kind of thing that one play can determine the futures of coaches and the futures of players and the futures of franchises. It should be a little more sophisticated. I mean, I can't believe
that.
What
do you mean? No, what do you mean? I mean, don't you think that's cool? Don't you think it's cool and novel, but mostly cool, that a folded up piece of paper impacts the future of two teams and maybe two head coaches? I mean, don't think that's cool? Are you telling me that's embarrassing and not cool?
It's not, Jim. It's a little embarrassing.
Right. I agree.
And this is sort of, I think you'll agree with this, why the league, despite all of the really crazy, horrible at times, goofy, stupid things it does, why it remains, I mean, it's slipping a little bit, but why it remains so popular is these type of things bring us back and make us talk about it. I mean, We're talking about a stupid catch rule. We're talking about a folded up piece of paper. And here we are with the league screwing things up, but it's still popular because of the people just like this kind of stuff, but they got to fix this.
Yeah, but Mike,
this makes the league look cheap.
Yeah, Mike, let me just jump in. I just want to say this. You're right. We are talking about that, and that's good. It's believe me, I like the debate. I like the conversation. I've got 3 hours to fill every single day. But what's it say about this issue of what is and what is not a catch that it keeps coming up year after year after year after year, and they still haven't fixed it?
I almost think they do it purposely, but I think it's just incompetence. It's just part of it is they don't know how the league doesn't know how to adapt to kind of the common sense part of football. They make everything too complicated, and it violates sort of what we see with our own eyes, and they can't match the two. It used to be really simple. Player had the ball, they crossed the goal line. As long as they had the ball, it was a touchdown. It was a simple thing, but they've complicated everything because they think they're smarter than everybody. And they think they need to make everything complicated when at its heart, football is such a simple, easy game. And they make it way too hard. And they just like sort of overthinking when some of these things are really, really simple, Jim.
Mike Freeman joining us. Now, Mike, obviously the game did not end right then and there. I mean, you might debate that it did. But while most of the discussion was focused on the non-catch, what do you make of Ben Roethlisberger tossing that pick after the fake spike?
It was, Roethlisberger said afterwards, it was just miscommunication. He thought he was going to spike it, and then the coaches were telling him not to. So it was kind of a communication screw-up, but still on him, I think it was for a guy who has played so incredibly well, it was a rare sort of he's made during the streak. And I'm telling you, Roethlisberger played up until that point. I mean, it's a huge point, obviously, but up until then, an almost flawless game. The stuff he was doing at the line of scrimmage, the time he was buying, the throws he was making were really, really incredible. I mean, he was outplaying Brady in a lot of ways. And then you see the difference, not that Brady's perfect, but you see the difference between Brady and other quarterbacks. Brady usually won't make that kind of pass. He'll throw it away. He'll do something really, really smart. He's not perfect. He makes mistakes. But most of the time, he makes the real smart decision. And you see why he's so different. And why I think he's a lock for the MVP now.
That's what I was going to say. Absolutely. I was just going to say that, Mike. Is there any doubt in your mind now that Tom Brady is going to be the MVP?
You could look at some other guys. Todd Gurley has been transformational. I mean, he's been unbelievable, and he destroyed the Seahawks single-handedly. You can look at Goff. There are some other guys, but going to Pittsburgh against a really, really good Steelers team, beating them there, playing as well as Brady did, plus with Brady's background, and he's so good anyway and so highly thought of anyway, it's almost a lock. I mean, I can't think of a bigger lock right now in the NFL outside of the NFL doing something stupid.
We're talking to Mike Freeman, NFL columnist for Bleacher Report. So, Mike, in the event that these two teams run into each other again, can the Steelers, who were playing a great game, they were winning that game, I mean, it looked like it was going to end. It was all going their way, even without Antonio Brown. As you point out, Roethlisberger was playing a great game. Can they beat the Patriots in New England in the playoffs, or as good as they are, is New England just too tough for everybody in the AFC?
I think they are the only team that could. Probably in New England. The Jaguars are tremendous, but I'm not sure about Bortles yet. There are some other teams that could make a run there. Baltimore gives them a hard time, maybe. But the only team that can beat them are the Steelers to me because they have the offense to keep up with the Patriots. And Roethlisberger is really good, and the Steelers are not intimidated at all playing there. I think they could beat them, even without Antonio Brown, and I'm not sure Antonio Brown's going to be back for a while. A torn calf is that's nothing to joke around about. But even without him, they can beat him there. We saw they played most of the game without him.
Right.
And that offense, Jim, is so deep with a lot of really talented players, and Le'Veon Bell is incredible. So, yes, they can beat New England there, and I think they're the only team that could.
Now, Mike, as great as that game was, was there a better moment all weekend than the one involving Clay Matthews and Cam Newton, where Matthews calls out a play that he was sure the Panthers were going to run? Cam hears him and says, quote, "You've been watching film, huh?" Matthew said, oh, yeah. And then Newton says, that's cool. Watch this. And then he throws the TD. Was there a better single moment in a game than that one?
I like how Matthew's calling out the wheel route. Here comes the wheel route.
Right.
And the wheel route was actually open, too. Everything was open on that play. If they mic'd up players, I would listen to 24/7 of mic'd up players, especially if they curse a lot. And I would love that. And there has to be a channel now dedicated to just mic'd up players. And I would listen to it with, like, my chocolate chip cookies and my Star Trek on the side and a little bit of diet soda, and I would stay up all night watching that.
Bro, you got a sad life, man. You got a sad life. I would not do that. I mean, I'd be into it for sure, but I would not put chocolate chip cookies off to the side and Star Trek off to another side and stay up all night doing that. You know why that is, Mike? Because I have a life. I would not do that,
Mike. I don't.
I know, bro. It's sad. It's sad. Now I'm sorry I asked that question. I'm really sorry I asked that question.
There's nothing sad about chocolate chip cookies and Trek and dudes cursing on tape, Jim.
No, there's a lot of things sad about that. The only thing good about that is the dudes cursing on tape. Hey, man, but I'm not here to judge, Mike. I'm not here to judge what you've done with your life and what's become of you. That's not my thing.
And by the way, Jim, I think with Aaron Rodgers, what do you do with him if you're the Packers?
Okay,
you're
what done, do you
your
do?
Season's over.
Right.
Do you sit him? I think that's a possibility. He wants to play because he's a competitor and he's a great player. But at some point, you really got to be careful and think, look, we're not going to get in the playoffs. Let's protect this guy and protect him from himself. And that's a big decision the Packers can make.
Is that your take, or do you think they'll do that?
I think they're going to listen to what Aaron says, and there's a good chance that he plays because Aaron wants to play. And there's some argument to you get him in the game, you get him some time going into next season.
Why?
But I don't think it's worth it.
Why?
I think
for who?
The
for
end,
what?
The Packers, it's just too risky. I mean, this is Aaron Rodgers, and he's still not completely healed. So I don't. If there was a chance that they could get in the playoffs, if they won this game, they could make a run and win all their games. That would be worth. But they lost, so now it's not. To me, it's not worth risking one of the most important players in the history of the sport, and who for the next 5 years is going to be your starting quarterback.
Yeah, I wouldn't do it.
To me, it's not worth it.
I wouldn't do it, Mike. I agree. I would not do it. You know, if you leave it up to Aaron, he's going to want to play. Obviously, he's going to want to play. But for who? For what? If mathematically they really have no shot whatsoever, I mean, why would the guy be out there? To prove what to whom? I personally would not do it. Before you go, let's talk about the Panthers quickly. What was your initial reaction to the report of workplace misconduct involving Jerry Richardson? Your initial response when that story first dropped?
Well, when I heard about him allegedly using a racial slur, it was like the least surprising thing I'd ever heard because there has been rumors about that for a while. And when he announced, when the team announced he was going to sell the team, it was clear that there was just going to be massive stuff the NFL was going to discover. I mean, my guess is that's just sort of the tip of the iceberg, that there's so much stuff that he's done, and it was going to get out, and it was going to be a big, big deal. So he decided, I'm just screw this. I'm getting out of it. But it shows you something that a lot of us have written about, and maybe you and I have talked about this, sort of the divide between ownership and players. You know, there's an element of ownership that is just very just not open-minded. I guess that's the best way to put it. There's a lot more owners, unfortunately, that are more like Richardson than not like him. Not all. There's some very progressive, open-minded owners, but the way Richardson reacted to Colin Kaepernick was a joke. And the league has to now take a good look at making the league more safe, more open-minded, less like the Jerry Richardsons of the world, more like the Crafts, and make the sport better for ownerships of play. It's a huge gap between owners and players, and this is one of the reasons why, because guys like Richardson.
All right, so Mike, what about this point that they want to quickly sell the team or make the announcement because maybe then the NFL will stop digging, the NFL will stop looking, they won't uncover all this, but is that necessarily the case? I mean, will the NFL continue to investigate him even though he said we're going to sell the team, and should they continue with that investigation?
Well, that's a great point. And my guess is, knowing the league, they won't. They'll keep. They're going to want to find out everything that they can. They're not going to stop. I don't think they're just going to close up the books and walk away. The only thing that may keep them from doing is they may not now want to know. They may just want to have blissful ignorance, which is not out of the question for the league. But my guess is they're going to want to find out everything, use it as, and talk to other owners and use it as sort of a teachable moment and make the league a little more forward thinking. And I think they're going to go forward with this. But it was Richardson doing this saved the league to me from a massive pile of embarrassing stuff. There may still be more stuff that may come out. It's already embarrassing enough, what Sports Illustrated reported. But I think from everything I've heard, that was just the tip of it. And it was just a lot more stuff.
Hey, listen, it's really embarrassing already.
Doing this. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. One more thought, Mike, before you go. What about the players? I mean, if the players know that the league will come down hard whenever there's a transgression, don't they want to see them hold the owners to the same standard to make sure that they're accountable as well? If this thing just kind of goes away, how will the players react? I got about a minute.
It's a great question. And the answer is, I think the players, this has been one of the biggest complaints of the players, that they're held to a different standard than people in management or Goodell. Like, players watch Goodell making $100 billion and go, why? I mean, when he signed his new deal, you saw some of the reactions of the players. They just shredded him. They want people to be held as accountable as they are, particularly owners. So the players may just say, use this as a moment to learn. But that's a great point and a great question. And the players are going to, I think, want to hear some accountability. And I think you'll see the union want to know what happened.
Rams 42, Seattle 7 in Seattle. Let me repeat that for a minute. Rams 42, Seahawks 7 in Seattle. In fact, I'm going to pause for a moment so you can repeat that to yourself and let that sink in. Here's the thing. That performance was so good, that beatdown so thorough, that I don't even need to drop Ram It In right now. You're probably already bumping it on a loop. I have been since I got back. Statement, hospital job, curb stomping, call it whatever you want, but it was all of that and even more. The Los Angeles Rams went into Seattle, one of the most hostile environments in the league, and they laid an absolute beating on the Seahawks. That's Seattle's worst loss under Pete Carroll. They go into Seattle's house, and they cleared that place out before the fourth quarter even started. A lot of 12s got all LA fan with it, bouncing and looking to beat traffic. Now remember, nearly a year to the day that they lost 24-3 in Seattle in a game where Jared Goff threw for 135 yards and Todd Gurley rushed for 38, the Rams come back and they blow the Seahawks out in a game where Jared Goff threw for even fewer yards. So how does that happen? Because Todd Gurley rushed for a 152 and 3 touchdowns. And he added 28 receiving yards and a receiving touchdown. So there was a whole lot of this.
He takes the snap, turns left shoulder, Todd straight ahead, Todd straight in! Touchdown, Todd Gurley! Touchdown, LA!
There was that, and then there was this.
Turns left shoulder, gives to Todd. Todd Gurley, touchdown! His second of the day, his 12th of the season.
And then this.
He turns left shoulder, gives to Gurley. Huge hole left side midfield. Gurley sprints to 40. Gurley first down. Gurley 20, 10, and touchdown! Todd Gurley on third down and 20 with a house call.
That's three for him. What the hell, T? Get it one more time.
Silent count has the snap. Scrambles to his right and throws. Gurley in the flat. Gurley at the 10. Gurley goes in. His fourth touchdown of the day. Three on the ground and now one through the air. Gurley going off in Seattle.
Let me say that one more time. LA 42, Seattle 7. 42-7 against one of the elite NFC teams for the past five seasons. The Rams team that lost in Seattle last year didn't have a head coach, didn't have an identity, didn't have Jack. This team has got the coach of the year. They most definitely have an identity, and they may have just won that division. Gurley said it best himself, quote, "We didn't want to let up. These guys have been kicking our ass for the last 10 or 15 years. You have to enjoy it. You have to take advantage of the situation." And again, no, I don't want to hear from Seahawks fans talking about all their injuries or about how that game would have been so much different if the Rams didn't keep getting such great field position. I mean, child, please. And Ram fan, don't you come in here either and tell me how you knew this was going to happen, how you saw this coming. Because you didn't. Nobody did. Not even the most diehard Rams fan. I don't care if you wake up every single morning to ram it and you consider your Jack Youngblood throwback to be formal wear. Even you did not see this coming. Don't tell me that you did, because you didn't. You didn't predict Todd Gurley dominating the Seahawks. You didn't see LA racking up 7 sacks. Only the players saw that. You know, guys like safety LaMarcus Joyner, quote, "I've seen it in OTAs. I've seen it in training camp. The continuity that we had, the belief that we had in one another. We win like this. It's no surprise to anyone," end quote. You see, that's the thing. It's a surprise to everybody except for the guys in that locker room. Just ask offensive lineman Roger Saffold, who's been with the Rams for 8 years. He says, quote, "Everything has changed. The way this team plays, the way they feel," end quote. And he's right. Everything has changed. When LA lost to Seattle 16-10 back in week 5, it was seen like that's a nice showing. Again, by everybody except those inside the locker room. From the sounds of it, everybody inside that locker room was actually pissed. Left tackle Andrew Whitworth said, quote, "We felt like we did not play to the capabilities that we thought were possible when we played them last time. And I think there was a lot of anger between us. We really just felt very disappointed in ourselves, in how we played the first time we played them, and really had a bunch of opportunities to win that game and just didn't. I think that meant a lot to us to really have the opportunity and go get it. I think guys felt that all week. There was an emotion behind that all week, and it showed today." It's amazing. Remember, this is a team that was 4-12 last season, and they were bent about losing a game to Seattle in week 5. Most teams that go 4-12 the previous year are taking victory laps after they keep it that close with Seattle. These guys, though, they were pissed. They were seething. They were waiting for a chance to get revenge, and they got it. And if you're still looking for a reason why Sean McVay should be the coach of the year, then you have it. That's it. Because they did not start believing in him and in themselves when they started winning. They started believing in him and themselves before they started winning. That's why he's the coach of the year. That's why they're a legitimate threat. Look, I get that Seattle was busted up. Now get this. Nobody gives a damn. Nobody cares. Not in that league. Really, not even in this world. No one wants to hear about your problems or your excuses. Scoreboard. Look up at it. And thanks for coming. The Rams are legit. And I hate to say it, 12 fan, that window is slammed shut. Seattle's window has officially slammed shut. I'm not saying that means the Rams can run the table. I am saying the NFC right now, they might run the table. This thing's wide open. But that was a serious, serious statement. Beat down, hospital job, curb stomp, whatever you want to call it. It was all of that and more. It was that impressive. Got a lot of different ways to beat you. Calais Campbell is my guest. Calais, it's great to have you back. How are you?
Hey, life is good, man. Life is real good right now.
My man, I bet. I bet. You had a monster game against Houston in that win, and you clinched Jacksonville's first trip to the playoffs since 07. So I've got to say, it's always good to wake up on a victory Monday, but how good did it feel to wake up on this particular victory Monday?
It feels real good. Anytime you punch your ticket to the dance, you know, that's just huge. You know, it guarantees you to the table to have opportunity for winning the championship. You know, that feels good. But at the end of the day, you know, you enjoy it for 24 hours and then you start trying to take the next step.
Now, in terms of opportunities, you had a lot of other opportunities as a free agent. Some of those were with teams that had done a lot more winning than Jacksonville had recently. So what did you see when you signed with that team, and how did you know that the guys could play at this level and have this kind of success immediately?
A lot of young talent. You know, I knew the team was very, very talented. You know, Tyler Smith, Jalen Ramsey, Yannick Ngakoue, you know, those guys were flashing on film. And, you know, I wanted to be a part of that, you know. So, with Tom Coughlin and, you know, what I know he's going to bring as far as, like, the leadership and accountability, it was Coach Marone's same kind of mentality, you know. So I did my research, everything just said that it was a smart move, you know, and I'm glad looking back on it, you know, it's been working out for me.
We're talking to Calais Campbell. You know, to that point that you just made, that you did the research, you thought about this, you did all your due diligence. Now, Calais, you're not this type of person, but now that you've clinched a spot in the postseason, is there any part of you that wants to go back to the folks who did question that decision at the time and say, what do you have to say for yourselves now? How do you like me now?
None of that. You know, I'm just enjoying the ride, you know, trying to get lost in the moment. You know, you never want to look back, you know, and never want to look too far forward, really, you know, just stay in the moment, you know, and, you know, I guess I look back when the season's over, you know, when we accomplish our goals, but right now, a lot of work to do, you know, time to look back at, you know, just got to keep our head down and keep grinding.
We're talking to Calais Campbell. All right, so when the season's over, you can look back. Now, you've not only been to the postseason, you have made a deep run in the postseason. So does this feel like a team that's got that kind of a run in them as well?
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt, you know, we know when we execute well, we play with energy, you know, we're a tough team to beat. You know, we know we can beat anybody. You know, the hard part is, you know, just continuously just staying lost in the moment, taking care of the small things, you know, being assignment sound. When we do that, though, you know, we're scary.
Calais, it sounds like, I mean, you mentioned that a couple of times right now, because you're somebody who's been here before and a lot of the guys in that locker room have not been here before. Has that essentially been your message? Yeah, we're in, but that's not the ultimate goal. You've got to keep your head down. Is that what you're telling your teammates?
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah, I tell them all the time, you know, stay lost in the moment. You know, take care of the small details. You know, stay with the routine that got you here. You know, don't relax. You can't take a deep breath. You know, just stay focused, you know. And, guys are listening. You know, nobody's, you know, overlooking the situation. They're kind of just taking it, you know, all in and enjoying the ride. You know, we play loose, we play fast.
We're talking to Calais Campbell. Jacksonville had a big win over the weekend again. Now, in the past 3 weeks, Blake Bortles has a 71% completion rate, 903 passing yards, 7 touchdowns, no interceptions. So what do you make of what you've seen from him over the course of the season, and most importantly, when it's mattered the most?
Man, yeah, he's been growing every day, you know, playing more and more loose, you know, just getting lost in the assignment, you know, and having fun. Taking calculated risks, you know, and making sure that he, you know, utilizing his playmakers around him. And he has a lot of speed at receiver. The O-lines are playing incredible, you know, and he's been leading the troops. You know, Blake Bortles he's playing on fire right now.
Now, Houston Texans Jadeveon Clowney had some choice words for him afterwards. Look, Clowney's a great player. We know this. But Bortles, when he was asked if he thought that Bortles was improving the way you just said he is, his response was, quote, he's trash. The guy was probably a little frustrated, but what's your response? What's your reaction when you hear that quote that he's trash from a guy like Clowney?
I mean, he's frustrated, you know, and I get it. You know, your team just lost, you know, 45-7. I mean, I get it, you know, and, you know, James Pass, you know, maybe he played well against Blake, but, you know, Blake is really found his groove, and he's playing well, you know, and, you know, I know Blake shook it off, you know, we shook it off, you know, we ain't worried about that no more, man. We just try to figure out how we could beat San Francisco, you know, and they got a great quarterback up there, hasn't lost an NFL game, hasn't lost an NFL start yet, you know, so we got our hands full, so we ain't worried about that at all.
Calais, collectively, what about your defense? It's a defense that is so deep and so nasty. How would you describe the mindset and the attitude of that crew?
We got a lot of swagger, a lot of confidence, a lot of guys taking turns making plays. I mean, we have so much talent on defense that we really don't have to do anything special. We just keep doing what we do, playing our assignment sound, you know, playing discipline, and good things are going to happen, so take turns. I mean, one game is Boyer, another game is Ramsey, another game is T-Jep or Barry Church, you know, Miles Jack, or, you know, down the list. I mean, everybody makes plays. Just take turns making plays.
You know, a couple of minutes ago, we talked about the decision you made and some of the research you did before you decided to sign there. Back in the offseason, when you had that decision, one of the guys you talked to was, among others, Chauncey Billups. What did the two of you talk about, and what was your takeaway from that conversation?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, Chauncey's just a, you know, a great mentor, you know, that I've had over the years. And really, you know, I know when, you know, he played with Detroit for a long time and he went back to Denver. You know, I was curious, you know, what made him want to go back to the Nuggets, you know, and, you know, I was curious what was the deciding factor of that, you know, because, I mean, that was, you know, opportunity for me later in my career, you know, to go back where we grew up, you know, and so I was just curious what the, you know, what was the deciding factor for him, you know, and a bunch of other things, you know, I mean, he's just a great role model, you know, to look up to, somebody I trust a lot, you know, so it was good to have that conversation.
Calais Campbell joining me for a couple of more moments. Now, earlier this month, the month of Jacksonville issued a proclamation declaring that you are the mayor of Saxonville. What has life been like for you in Jacksonville and Saxonville?
Well, since that came out, I've been teased a lot in the locker room, you know, but that's how it is. I expected it, you know, but it's kind of cool. It's just, you know, I mean, we're having a lot of fun playing the game we love. You know, Saxonville's a cool nickname, you know, because it gives the D-line a lot of love. But really, you know, I mean, our team, top to bottom, you know, different guys making big plays at different moments. You know, we're just enjoying the ride, trying to take advantage of our opportunity. We know the window don't stay open long. You know, next year, you know, we're not guaranteed to be, you know, any good. You know, I mean, right now we're in a situation where we have momentum on the side. We've been winning games. So we're trying to capitalize on the moment.
Clayus, you've done your very best not to make it about you. I know you're not going to make it about you. I know you're not going to say it, so I will. You're a huge reason why this team is headed to the postseason. And as I mentioned off the top, you've already broken the single-season record for sacks for that franchise. You added two more. How much pride do you take in the fact that you've had this kind of an impact on this team so far this season?
I take a lot of pride that our goals are being reached. You know, we set some big goals at the beginning of the year. Nobody really gave us the opportunity or a chance to really to reach them. You know, only us in the locker room. So, you know, we've worked really hard. You know, we sacrificed, and now we have a chance. You know, and so I take a lot of pride in the opportunity.
So just to really recap quickly the NFL weekend. I mean, amazing weekend, right? There were the Pats and the Steelers game, which had all those was-it-a-catch-or-was-it-not-a-catch wounds being ripped open once again. I mean, while there's nothing as tired as the phrase, hold my beer, it really was like the Cowboys and Raiders game saw that Pats and Steelers game and said, hold my beer, because they had not one but two really bizarre moments. There was Gene Steratore busting out some paper to measure for a first down in the Cowboys-Raiders game, which was weird and it was embarrassing. But you know what's even more weird and more embarrassing than measuring for first downs with two sticks and some chain? Measuring for first down with two sticks, some chain, and a piece of paper. What, popsicle sticks and string did not want any of that? And then the game ended on this play from Derek Carr.
Derek in the shotgun, looks left, pumps, gets pressured. Derek gets out to his right. Derek gonna run. He's got the first down. He dives for the pylon. Where are they gonna spot him? He's got the first down.
The ruling on the field is a touchback. First down.
He fumbled the ball. Derek Carr fumbled the ball. He lost the ball diving for the pylon. The Raiders are going to lose the game.
Raiders radio with that call. Look, if the catch rule is the most confusing part of the NFL rulebook, then the touchback fumble rule, where the defense gets the ball back on a play where they don't actually recover it, has got to be one of the wackest. However, all of that pales in comparison to the situation involving Jerry Richardson. The team announced on Friday they were starting an internal investigation into allegations of workplace misconduct by team owner Jerry Richardson. First of all, there was a negative reaction from other teams that the Panthers were going to conduct their own investigation into their own owner, and that the investigation would have input from Erskine Bowles, who is a minority owner. So that led the league to announce that it would take on the investigation itself. But then came that report from SI, and it's ugly. I mean, really, really ugly. John Wertheim and Viv Bernstein reported that at least four former Panthers employers have reached significant monetary settlements from Richardson or from the team in exchange for what amounted to a vow of silence. In other words, hush money. Hush money from four that we know of. Among the incidents mentioned in the report are what appear to be a pattern of allegedly asking female employees who were wearing jeans on Fridays to turn around so he could, quote, admire their backsides, and then make comments about that. Also, reportedly inviting female employees to give him foot rubs, and him giving back rubs that, quote, lingered too long and went too low down the spine, end quote. And that list goes on and on. Quote, multiple female employees recalled to SI that Richardson asked them if he could personally shave their legs. He was asking them if he could shave their legs. Then there was a repeated move that multiple female employees referred to as the seatbelt maneuver, where he'd invite a female employee to lunch, and because he's a gentleman, he would open the car door for them. But according to SI, quote, once they were seated, however, he would insist on fastening their seatbelt for them, reaching across their lap and brushing his hand across their breasts before putting the belt in the clasp, end quote. So the seatbelt maneuver, the can I shave your legs maneuver, and the seatbelt maneuver. Additionally, on top of all that, There's also an allegation of directing a racial slur at a team scout that led to a settlement. So the controversies on the field are bad, and they'll get more attention, but this is worse. This is much, much worse than what's a catch or what's not a catch. Richardson then quickly announces he's going to sell that team, a move which was greeted with sadness by Jerry Jones, the Cowboys owner, obviously shaken up by this and saddened by the whole thing.
I'm sad. I'm very sad. Jerry is one of the really, really, really outstanding men of football that I've ever met, and I really admire him. And I know that he made it the old-fashioned way. He worked for it. And he took what he made in his short time in pro football and turned it into a great business and then used that to get the Carolina franchise. So he's a great story.
That's Jerry Jones. And Jerry went on to say, quote, "I'm saddened by any of the stories or things that might have incited this at this time. He's a battler. He's a big man with a big heart. And by the way, there's somebody else's heart. He's had a heart transplant." He also added, quote, "He'll be the first to tell you he's had a blessed life. I'm really sad. I want all those kind of men that we can have in the National Football League." End quote. Let me run that back one more time. "I want all those kind of men that we can have in the National Football League." Hey, Jerry, you do know why this guy's selling the team, right? You know why your guy is selling his team, right? He's selling the team because he's been accused of multiple acts of sexual harassment and at least one incident of a racial slur. You do know that, right? You know that's why he's selling the team. Hearing that news and then going out of your way to hype this guy as an amazing businessman and an even better human being is not a good look, Jera. It's not a good look at all. Look, I get that this might be your guy. I get that this might be your friend. But when someone is accused of what he's been accused of, and there may be way more of that coming still ahead, maybe you don't say, quote, "I'm really sad. I want all of those kind of men that we can have in the National Football League," end quote. I don't know if you've read that article, but reading the SI article, you don't want any of those kind of men in the National Football League. Or any other workplace for that matter. And no, saying, quote, "I'm saddened by any of the stories or things that might have incited this at this time," does not really address what he's been accused of. In fact, it does the exact opposite. It minimizes it. It ignores it completely. If your response to Jerry Richardson's accusations is you're sad that these, quote, stories, you called them stories, these stories are forcing him to sell his team at what will no doubt result as a massive profit, then you're completely missing the point. And why did this happen as quickly as it did? Why did that story break? And then within hours, why did he say that he was going to sell that team? Probably because he was going to sell the team anyway in the next few years. And probably because he wanted to try and get out in front of this and maybe make the whole thing go away. Maybe he thought by saying, "I'm going to sell this team," the NFL might just kill the investigation altogether before it gets any worse. Because it will. It'll get worse. It'll get much worse. But then again, the league might not kill the investigation. Now, let's not forget, they started off by saying, "We're going to investigate ourselves." A minority owner was going to investigate the majority owner. And then when they knew that obviously was arrogant and was not going to fly, the league jumps in there. But this might not be enough to get the league to kill the investigation. Look, it shouldn't. If you're going to investigate and discipline your players for misconduct, you better hold your owners to the same standard. And I'm not sure he's the only owner who's demonstrated workplace misconduct. Although he might be the only one who offered to help them with their seatbelt and to shave their legs. At least I hope so. I mean, that's really creepy and really revolting and pretty despicable. Creepy, revolting, and despicable enough that within hours he said, "I'm selling the team." You know, a team that meant more to him than anything else. I want to talk about the Browns, talking about a group of guys that have their bleep together. We finally have an answer to the oldest, most debated question in the history of really not even the NFL, but sports overall. Is Joe Flacco an elite quarterback? After yesterday, I can confidently say, in a word, in fact, in two words, hell yes.
Hell yes.
Hell yes. Forget ripping an MVP trophy in Super Bowl 47. Jay Flack may have ripped an even bigger game than that. The biggest game of the year. The biggest game of any year. Because any game that the winless Browns are playing in is the biggest game of the year. The biggest game of any year. And Flacco was not messing around. He knew what was at stake. He knew how big that stage was. He did not wait until the fourth quarter to wake up. He did not need overtime to finally knock out C-Town like Green Bay did a week earlier. Nope. This was a good old-fashioned, worry-free, nice, swift, 27-10 ass-kicking. And a welcome change of pace from that sweat fest against the Packers last week. As for the Browns, you really cannot ask any more than they gave you. DeShone Kizer shows up, mans down, and somehow, some way, finished the first quarter with negative 12 yards passing. I didn't even know that was possible, but that's the type of effort that I'm talking about. That's what you need to do to live the dream. You need to finish what you start. Now is not the time to start trying. Now is not the time to show how much you care. Why? Why? And ruin all the hard work that you and everybody else in that facility have put into this dream season. Hell no. I need a hero, and Kizer is that hero. And now the Browns are right back where they were last season. They're 0-14. They're two games from history. But don't look for me to pop the bottle yet. Hell, I haven't even bought the bottles yet because I'm not about to get caught with my hand on the cork, not with this team, not after last year, not when they have a very recent track record of choking out in week 16, and not, most of all, when the 4-10 Bears are up next. Hey, Mitch Trubisky, you want to prove that you're worth that number two pick overall? Here you go. Do your job. Win one for Van Smack. My favorite stat from yesterday is that Jimmy Garoppolo now has two more wins with the 49ers in three games than Hugh Jackson has with the Browns in two seasons. I mean, that's even better than a quarterback starting or finishing a quarter with minus 12 yards passing. The only thing more embarrassing than losing for a 29th time in 30 games was apologizing for it afterwards.
I apologized to our fans that we wasn't able to do that, to get a home victory in our stadium. And I said that to our players. But hopefully this is the end of all of that. I hope it is. You know, I'm not going to make any guarantees that it is because you never know. It can't get much worse than this, true? It can't. I've never gone any place and left it worse than what I found it. And I'm not going to run from this. So I'm going to be here, and I need to get this fixed.
God, that's incredible. That is one of the most amazing sound bites ever. Especially that part where he says he's never left a place worse than when he got there. Yet, can I tell you something? You know how crappy that place was when he got there? But he's never left a place worse. Do you know how bad that place was when he arrived there? He turned a 3-13 team into a 1-15 team, and a 1-15 team into an 0-14 team. So there was a razor-thin margin to do worse. I mean, you really couldn't have done any worse when you arrived there. But somehow he's managed to do even worse, which is awesome. 14 down, 2 to go. Don't you dare go turning this thing around right now, Hugh. Do not turn around this sinking ship. Finish the job, Hugh. Finish the job. And listen, if you want to go back to Cincinnati and replace Marvin Lewis, as has been suggested, you go right ahead and you do that. But not before you finish the job with Cleveland. And if I'm Cincinnati, I am not going to bring in a guy who chokes on the biggest stage. He and they did last year. They melted down. They imploded. They won after that perfect 0-14 start. So if I'm the Bengals, hey, never mind for a minute that Marvin Lewis disputed that report that he's stepping down at the end of the year. I don't know if he is or if he isn't. And I like Marvin, but he should. Clearly that message does not work there anymore. He needs a change. They need a change. He should step down if he's not. But even if he does, if I'm the Bengals, honestly, frankly, Hugh, you're a good football guy. But if I'm the Bengals or any other team in the NFL for that matter, and I see a coach that does not have his team ready to lose after losing 14 straight and 29-30. And then you turn around You win that game. And then you turn around and you do it again the next season? I'm not going anywhere near a guy like that. Do your job. And by do your job, I mean keep doing what you're not doing. Don't do anything at all. Make sure that is the message to your team. Just keep doing what you're not doing and finish the job. Do your job by not doing your job and finish this thing right now. 1-15 is for losers. 2-14 is a waste of everybody's year, of everybody's life. 0-16 is forever. Finish the job.
I've never gone anyplace and left it worse than what I found it.
You have now, Hugh. You have now. Absolutely, you have now. I like this guy. That hurts me to have to do that. But it's going to hurt a hell of a lot more if they win, honestly. It's going to hurt a hell of a lot more if they win. Just finish it. Just lie down. What good is trying right now? Just lie down. Trust me, it'll feel good. It'll feel great. Just do it. I did go to New York. It was great. A little bit cold, but it was great. Some snow, but not very much. It was all good. The most challenging thing about those trips now are the travel itself. And for whatever reason, I've done this now for, I think it's my third NFL season. And last year I made 8 trips back to New York. This year it's going to be 7 trips because I did my first hit from here in Southern California. So I've done that 6 times. 7 of the 8, I'm going to do one more for the AFC Championship game. You would think I would have this down, right? So I go to LAX yesterday. I fly out of LAX. And I get to the airport a little bit early. Head over to the lounge. Get a cup of Joe. Doing my thing. It's all good. And I look down into my briefcase. I'm like, damn, my lapper's gone. And I allegedly lost my laptop. You know, nice MacBook laptop. The only thing worse than that is it's happened more than once. It's a 2017 lapper. But I didn't panic because I knew exactly where it was. But I didn't know whether or not I would have time to go back and retrieve it and make it back to my plane. So I'm playing it off like I'm not panicked, like I'm not freaking out when you know I am. Like, what a moron, right? I left it at security. And if you're asking yourself, hey, idiot, who comes out of the security line and forgets a laptop computer? My response would be me, and more than once. But what happens is now, during the holidays, and no excuses, right? I mean, that's totally on me 100%. But what's happening during the holidays is, you can imagine the airports are total clusters, man. It is crazy. It's nuts. So they're pushing people through security, and we're all trying to get our stuff and get out of there as quickly as possible. And not only that, it's getting actually a little bit more challenging. It used to be like you get in line, and you take your laptop out, and then you slam everything else in one bin. But now it's gotten to the point where you need multiple bins for everything, and it's not a two-bin thing anymore. Now it's like 3 or 4 or 5. Yeah, whatever it is, I'm trying to build this up like it wasn't my fault, even though it was my fault. So I run out of there, shoes, jacket, belt, briefcase in its own bin, and I go to the lounge to get my Joe, and I'm all good. But then I look down there, and it's gone. So I work my way back to security, trying not to look like I'm panicked when I am, and there's this big sign that says, do not enter. Do not enter. Obviously, once you come out of security, you can't go back in. And I'm like, I'm screwed. There's no way. I'm going to New York without my lapper. But I kind of walk through getting ready to get berated, and I'm not berated. And this young woman who's there at the desk goes, is your name Jim? Yes, ma'am. How do you know? Because I turned on your computer. I couldn't get into it, but it comes up, Jim Rome. She said, where's your ID? I said, right here, ma'am. She goes, here you go. I said, how'd you know it was me? Was it that panic look on my face? That's happened twice. Twice. Only an idiot would lose his laptop at security, and it's happened to me twice. That is two for me, Alvy.
It's two for me.
And the only thing worse than that is I'm coming home last night, and I'm on the flight. And remember, this is how this works, right? Keep in mind, Saturday morning, LAX, early out, flying to New York. New York in December is gorgeous, man. It is so cool. It is beautiful, but it's even worse than LA in terms of traffic. So late night into the hotel, do the morning show, the NFL on CBS, which is awesome. And then I turn around and I fly right back. So I'm generally kind of fried. On the plane last night, 6 hours, about 4 hours in, knocked my phone off the desk. Lost my phone in the chair. That's happened twice. I lost my iPhone after almost losing my laptop. And now I've got no shame. Literally, I'm on all fours. The plane's totally dark. There is no light, and I'm looking for a phone, and it's gone. It's literally disappeared right into my chair. And as you know, I'm a degenerate, so I've got the 10. I've got the brand new iPhone 10, which is more important to me than anything I've ever owned in my life. And I can't find the phone. And this has happened twice now. So I've got the chair and I'm running it back and forth, backward and forth. It's grinding up the phone. Finally pull the phone out. Long and short of it is, if I had to lose either my laptop or my phone, I'd rather lose the laptop, which cost four times as much. All day long, I want that phone more than I want the laptop. Can't live without the phone. You can have the laptop. I'll figure out a way around that. So that's got to be some kind of record, right? Has anybody lost both their laptop and their phone in the same 24-hour period traveling? It's got to be a world record. I'm the only guy that could pull that off. Got them both back. Yeah, I mean, you could say, hey, Rome, how about a TSA pre-appointment? I guess. Maybe, kind of. But if I'm not smart enough not to lose my phone and my laptop, do you really think I'm bright enough to pull that off? I do have Clear. I do have Clear, which helps sometimes. And then, of course, when you do that, you get that look like, hey, douchebag, why are you cutting the line? You know, I don't like to go with that phrase on this show either, but honestly, that's the look you get. Hey, D-bag, why are you cutting the line? I don't know, because I paid whatever it costs to get Clear, and you can too. And if I don't do it, and I get in line with everybody else, I'll freak out and lose my laptop and my watch and whatever else I have. That's that New York bender, man. That's that New York trip. You never know. I never know what I'm going to come home from. And don't even get started like on wardrobe, the things I leave there. That's always an embarrassing call too. To my guy, Drew Kaliski, who's like this brilliant, brilliant, brilliant guy who runs the show. He runs that show. Drew does. And so when I talk to Drew about content, that stands to reason, right? He's my boss. Well, I got lots of bosses, but he's one of my bosses. He's the guy that I run all my takes through, my content through. He tells me what I need. The one thing I don't want to do is call Drew and say, hey, Drew, left my tie and my shoes and, and my vest. Can you see if maybe that stuff's still lying around? I got to get my bleep together, right? That's it for now. Monday's in the books. Tomorrow's Podcast Tuesday, and my guest is Keegan-Michael Key. Most talented guys I've ever spoken to or ever met. You do not want to miss that. Trust the podcast and check back here tomorrow. See you then. We're out.